Los Angeles. You're now tuned into Slauson Girl Speaks
with award-winning journalist and South Central native, Slauson Girl.
This is a safe space.
Yeah!
Celebrating authentic black expression.
Where Slauson Girl dives deep
into Los Angeles history,
politics, and news.
While discussing culture, race, and identity with carefully curated guests
to keep you open-minded in today's society.
No cap.
Follow Slauson Girl on all social media platforms and stream Slauson Girl Speaks on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You don't want to miss this.
Thank you to Swift Cafe, who is the sponsor for this episode of Slauson Girl Speaks. Swift Cafe is located in the heart of the Crenshaw District, right across from the Mer Park. Their menu is filled with items that are creative, nutritious, and full of flavor. They always have seasonal and surprise menu items, and they serve a special brunch menu every third Saturday. They are open Wednesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 o'clock p.m. A special shout out to Chef Kendra, who is the owner and head chef of Swift Cafe. You can read my interview with Chef Kendra of Swift Cafe on sauceandgirl.com. Check them out and tell them Sauce and Girl sent you. Today on Slauson Girl Speaks, I will be speaking with Eric Strong, who is running for LA's top cop position, the LA County Sheriff. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department is one that has been involved in immense controversy, from police-involved shootings as well as the Trump-like behaviors of our current sheriff, Alex Villanueva, just in terms of his unwillingness to work with different departments and his defiance. I think defiance is a good word. Alex Villanueva has also lost several key endorsements since his election, and it has left people wanting his seat, basically. And Mr. Strong is one of those people. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for asking. So kind of, you know, hop right into this. So you've been working in law enforcement for more than 30 years.
Close to 30 years.
You've been working in law enforcement close to 30 years. And what are some of the issues that you're seeing in law enforcement that is motivating you to want to run for sheriffs?
Most importantly, I think the issue that I'm seeing is that in those 30 years, mm-hmm. when you really look at it, not much has changed. Last year, 2021, was the 30-year anniversary of Rodney King, which occurred in 1991. And when we look nationwide about some of the incidents that are happening, some of the racially motivated stops, shootings, uses of force, I really feel overall not much has changed. I think it's just a much bigger eye on it. Now a lot of the public are seeing it, and it's coming to light. And it's really something that many communities have been crying out for a very long time. Technology has changed. We have the ability to be more transparent with cameras, but we're still using some of the same taglines of, you know, it's an open investigation.
Right.
We're still keeping people out saying, well, it's for safety and so forth. So I really don't think much has changed at all, which is part of the problem.
Okay. And what do you think is some of like the main hindrance of, you know, police reform and changing the culture? Like, what are some of the main things that's stopping that?
I don't think law enforcement really wants it. You know, in order to really change the culture and that reform, one of the big proponents of reform and one of the big components of it is transparency. Mm-hmm. And that means we have to open our doors. It means we have to let people in. It means we can't keep closing our doors and keep our jails locked up and keep our stations locked up. And it means we have to share what our policies are. I have found over my years that we put a lot of effort into writing it right. and I say W-R-I-T-E, it R-I-G-H-T. So when an incident happens, and it could be a civilian complaint, it could be a use of force incident, you know, and it doesn't have to be the major stuff. But we spend a lot of time justifying the action. And if people don't know what our policies are, if they don't know what our practices are, if they don't know what our tactics, if they don't know what we're supposed to do, it's very hard for them to be critical of how we do it. So when all we do is give a blanket statement of, well, we looked into it and we took administrative action, what does that say? It doesn't say anything. So I think a lot of that's just an example. I think a lot of the challenge and the roadblocks are law enforcement itself. They're not willing to actually give, you know, the community that open access.
Okay. And so when you say that some of the roadblocks are law enforcement themselves, you know, we have a current sheriff who, again, is very, the word that's coming to mind is defiant. He's very set in his own ways and how he chooses to police. And it's kind of like his way or kind of no way. He doesn't want to work across county departments. He doesn't want to work with civilian oversight committees and things like that. What would you say that you bring personally in terms of like leadership qualities that are like the polar opposite of what we see with Sheriff Villanueva right now?
That's an interesting question. You know, I've known him for probably 17, 18 years. And what we're seeing in him is no surprise to people that know him. He was honestly a poor leader. He was actually my sergeant at one time. And he was a poor leader back then. He has always felt like he's the only one with the answers. He's always felt like he's the smartest person in the room. I don't think he typically got along with very many people. So what I bring to the table is a willingness to listen. I want people smarter than me at the table so that they can bring ideas. I think I bring a better character, a sense of class and decorum that he does not demonstrate at all. I know how to get along with people. I know how to communicate with people. I know how to engage with them. And I know how to be able to walk away from a meeting, you know, agreeing to disagree, but be respectful and walk away, you know, making everybody feel we made progress, even if we didn't come away with complete agreement. And I think for the most part, just our character, you know, and who he is as a person. I bring a lot more experience to the table than he ever had. And I think a lot more credibility as well.
Okay. So when you say like, you know, you work with him and you're familiar with his character and leadership qualities, so the way that he's running things doesn't come as a surprise to you, right? So how do you think that he could actually get elected displaying these type of like qualities in the past?
You know, interesting. He got elected. He didn't get elected displaying those. Mm-hmm. And throughout this campaign, I've talked to a lot of people, a lot of organizations, and they feel like they were lied to. Mm-hmm. He fooled them. He tricked them. And which is interesting because I think at the time, you know, there were only, I think, three candidates in that race. And I've been told, like, you know, number one, he was the Democrat in the race. And a lot of people voted for him because his last name was Villanueva. Mm. And they really didn't dig in and do their homework. Mm. And I think that's what is different about this race. People mm-hmm. want to do their homework now. People want to say, wait a minute, you know, we got tricked. We got fooled once before. We're not going to let that happen again. So they're doing a lot more homework. So he just basically spoke and people wanted to believe him and they did. Mm-hmm. And then when he got in office, he showed who he really was and had been all along.
Right. Okay. So you're running as a progressive. How is that different from running as a Democrat or a Republican?
You know, I think I'm running as a person with ideas that really want to open the doors for law enforcement. Mm-hmm. I have seen for the last 30 years, mm-hmm. The challenges, the failures, and the successes of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that for what we've been doing all along, in many ways, it works and it's successful, but in many ways and in many communities, it's not. You know, and so at some point, when do you say, look, this isn't working anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to running, as opposed to like a Democrat or a Republican, I really am just running to do what's best for the people. And when I say for people, all communities, not just certain communities, not to over-police one community and not over-police another community, not to have racially motivated incentives to do things. You know, bottom line is this. If we're going to treat one community one way, then all communities need to be treated that way. And that shouldn't be in a bad way. Everybody should be treated with compassion, respect, dignity. We shouldn't be degrading anybody.
Right.
So that's really what I'm running on. And I'm running on the fact that we're not going to find our solutions to most of our crises in a jail cell. We've been doing that forever. Mm-hmm. You know, mental health is a crisis. You know, the unhoused is a crisis. People with addiction. And all we've been doing is putting them in jail. And guess what? We're still where we are. So we got to try something different. To me, it just makes sense. And it's what's best for people.
Excuse me. Sorry. So. So you've mentioned that you do not support the rebuilding of another jail in Los Angeles. What are some alternative methods of rehabilitation that you envision as an alternative to not having jails?
So it's kind of a two-part answer to that. And let me just say this. Again, the solutions, the sustainable solutions to some of our problems are not in a jail cell. It just creates a revolving door. Men's Central Jail is old. It's antiquated. I worked there. I mean, it's historic. I mean, it really is. But is it serving its purpose? If the purpose is only to lock people up, then sure, it's serving a purpose for those that's all they want.
Mm-hmm.
But if the purpose is to rehabilitate, if the purpose is to offer services, be it health services, be it mental health services, be it behavioral, be it addiction, we can't do that in a jail. You know, right now we're running the largest mental health hospital around, and there's something wrong with that when 30% of our population has mental health issues, but yet and still they're in jail. And so let's really look at that. Let's take a crime, whatever that crime is. What came first? Did the person commit the crime because they're a criminal with mental health issues, or did the mental health issues and maybe addiction issues push them into committing that crime?
Right.
So we have to get to the root causes if we want to fix it. If we were to get rid of Men's Central Jail, it would do a few things. It would, number one, open up those employees, those deputies, those custody assistants, those professional staff, to put them in other areas where they're much needed. You know, we're killing our employees right now on overtime. We're making them carp. They're just being overworked. And they're spread too thin. So that's number one. Number two is we're going to help build union jobs. You know, if we bring in healthcare workers, if we bring in mental health workers, and we employ them, and what all the professional staff that goes with that, we're helping build unions. We're helping build, you know, middle class, and we're giving, you know, basically living wages for people that we can also provide those services. And I think the other main component is that if we really look at it and we want to talk about the services that are provided inside a jail, are we giving them the sustainable services? Because here's what happens. Somebody comes into our custody. They do get health care. They get medical care while they're in there. They get mental health care while they're in there. But what happens when they get out? Where do they go? You know, if somebody has high blood pressure or diabetes or needs drugs for, or, you know, medication for mental health, what are they walking away with and what are they going to?
Right.
You know, right now they may walk away with a few days worth of whatever their medication is. And then they're right back into that, you know, that decompensation that they were in before. And the last part I'll say about rehabilitation is that inside of our jails right now,
mm-hmm.
we have a lot of inmate workers that do much of the work that goes on.
Right.
And I'll speak to one that I'm very familiar with, food services.
Mm-hmm.
So 65 locations. They also service 30 some odd, and don't quote me, but 30 plus outside agencies. And it's basically industrial cooking, right? Now, what would you need if you wanted to go to a restaurant or go to someplace and say, hey, I want to apply to be a cook here? You're going to say, well, what certification do you have? What industrial cooking experience do you have? What can you bring me from some certified school that says that you know the temperatures, hot and cold, that you know how long this has to be cooked?
Right.
Nothing. But guess who's doing the work on the inside?
The prisoners.
The inmate workers. Yeah, the inmates. Yes. So they're doing the work, and what they're really doing it for is a little bit of extra freedom and a little bit of extra food, right? But why aren't we giving them some type of education component, some type of credentialing, and then setting them up? And there's programs out there that would happily employ them coming out.
Right.
So we have to do a better job at better preparing them. They should be coming out better than when they went in.
Right.
And right now, that's not the case.
Okay, definitely. So I kind of want to throw this question out there for you. You know, our new district attorney, George Gascon, he has came in with some very important directives that would shift the a lot of the ways in which LA polices and criminalizes people, right? A lot of it that was rooted in racist policies, right? So some of the work, not some of the work, like the work that he's doing is important to, you know, like the 70s and 80s in LA, the 90s too, saw a lot of people caught up in the system and kind of just funneled through the system, right? A lot of wrongful convictions and things like that as well. And so what he's doing is really important, but he's been getting a lot of pushback, you know, from people within his own department, from a lot of political kind of like watchdog groups. And, you know, there's just been a lot of conversation and criticism that he's been, so much so that he's began to kind of walk back some of the directives that he was putting forth in the beginning in terms of, I think some things that I saw was like the ways in which juveniles were going to be, don't quote me, but I know for sure he was saying that he was going to walk some things back. And it probably was coming from the public criticism and pressure and lack of support from key areas of people. And so what would your response be to someone that says, you know, man, I'm sure Eric Strong wants to and, you know, is focused on shifting the department and police reform, but it's just beyond the scope of one person. You know what I'm saying? Like, what would you say to people that may have confidence in you, but just don't have confidence in one person shifting an embedded culture?
Yeah, very good question. And you know what? I can't do it by myself.
Mm-hmm.
No one person can do it. You know, it's going to take collaborative effort, but it's going to take somebody to start. And it's going to take somebody in law enforcement to start moving that forward.
Right.
And I don't expect to do it by myself. I'm going to have to get buy-in. I'm going to have to get support, and I'm going to have to bring stakeholders to the table. And it's going to be a building process. It's not going to change overnight. But what we can do is we can keep doing what we've been doing and not make any progress, or we can get somebody in that is about the progress and is going to start that ball rolling. And I think that's who I really am. I'll be the first to tell you that it's going to take a big collaborative effort, and it's going to take a lot of talking, and it's going to take a lot of balance. You know, so we can't just go, you know, extreme one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to find some balance. And, you know, that's why I'm looking forward to bringing other people to the table. I mean, I'm endorsed by some clubs, and the one thing that they are looking for, they like, is the fact that, look, come be a stakeholder at this table. You know, come sit at the table and have a voice. Give me ideas. Let's talk about it. Let's discuss it. Let's bounce it back and forth, and let's come up with sustainable solutions.
Okay, definitely. So can you speak at all to some of the support that you would need from stakeholders, like community members, political groups, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, all the support I can get. You know, here's the reality of it is that in order to get, you know, into this position, it's going to require votes.
Right.
You know, in order to get those votes, I need exposure.
Right.
You know, and so, and that exposure also comes from donations, which help you get that exposure. So I'm looking for ideas. One of the things I want people to know is that I'm listening. I have a 25-point plan that I've been working on for a while. And I'm very proud to say that three of those plans came directly from meet and greets, town halls, people I didn't know that said, hey, have you ever thought about this? You know, and it was an idea that was tossed out there, but we actually kind of peeled the onion layers back a little bit and kind of dug into it. And it's really good ideas based on what people have experienced, you know, and any person, any community, I don't care, you know, where they're from, they can tell their story and they can tell you what they need better than I can. I can tell you what I need.
Right.
You know, I can tell you what I know a lot of people want and what I'm hearing, but individuals and groups can tell their story and they need to be able to do that. They need to have a platform to do that. And they need somebody willing to listen. And believe me, I'm not going to take the ideas and say, hey, you know, this is Eric Strong. We came up with this great idea. Mm-hmm. No, you know, Lillian Cabral is going to get credit for her idea. You know, Jessica Corday is going to get credit for her idea. And we're going to put those things together and, you know, and just make them beneficial for everybody.
Okay, definitely. So an issue in the Black community is a lot of like apathy towards the political process, right? Like a lot of people are completely checked out because they feel that nothing changes, you know, and things like that. What would you say to Black people in Los Angeles in terms of why they should be invested in the Los Angeles sheriff's race?
Well, I think law enforcement and the Black community have been at, you know, had some struggles here recently and for a very long time. And that's putting it mildly.
Right.
Here with the sheriff's department, they can have input. They can have input on who's the sheriff. Now, they may not have a lot of input on who's the police chief of Gardena PD or Long Beach PD or Inglewood PD, but the sheriff, they get a vote, they get a say. And we need to educate them on that. A lot of people just don't know. You know, they don't know that they get to vote for the sheriff. And so if they don't do anything else, they should say who they don't want. You know, because if you don't get out and get involved, you're just going to get who you get.
Right.
And then you just got to deal with it. At least be part of the process. And that's huge. And I think we need to get that message out.
Definitely. And I encourage Black people to definitely be involved in the political process, because I'm seeing a lot of different groups swaying the political field in LA. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are not involved a lot of times in the process outside of like our older Black folks, you know. But yeah, millennials, get active. So let's talk a little bit about your introduction into law enforcement. You started with the Compton Police Department in the early 90s. What were some of your motivations behind going into law enforcement?
You know, I honestly, growing up, I didn't want to be in law enforcement. So my mom worked right here at Compton Courthouse. I mean, before they even built this courthouse here, I remember as a kid coming when it was just a one or two story building. My dad was a Compton police officer.
Oh, wow.
So I, you know, growing up, I thought I wanted to be an attorney because I seemed to always be around the law. She worked there and I remember sitting in her courtrooms and you know, watching the judges and the process and everything take place. But somewhere along the line, as I got older, you know, and I was going to school and I worked for a law firm, I said, you know, this is not what I want to do, because to me, it didn't feel like I was really helping people. It didn't feel like I was really doing anything. And maybe I was in the wrong aspect of law. And being a young man, I felt like, you know what, I want to do more. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that I would get into law enforcement, make my contribution, learn as much as I could from the law enforcement side, and then go back to school and maybe become an attorney. But I got into law enforcement. I never looked back. I mean, just the impact that you can have. I really see that, you know, the reality of it is there's thousands of good women and men out there that do a good job every day. But we are tainted and our reputation is broken from a few. That's a few too many. But I think for me, the introduction was just really getting out there and seeing the impact, you know, and seeing people say thank you and helping and feeling like, you know, you're making a contribution. you know, to the overall public safety.
Okay, definitely. So I was mentioning to you when I had read that you started out in Compton in the early 90s, something that popped in my brain was like, oh, you know, Death Row and that connection that they have with the Compton Police Department with some of the officers working as like off duty security. And then waters got a little bit more muddier, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, like, were you around during any of that activity with the Death Row and things like that? And what kind of like do you remember from like the early 90s working in the Compton Police Department and like they're mixed in the hip hop world?
You know, I was around for, I mean, the vast majority of it. You know, I remember, first of all, let me say this. I never worked for Death Row.
It's important.
I never did any security whatsoever. Okay. But I can tell you that as an early person, when it wasn't Death Row, but it was NWA, I'm sorry, when they were doing some of their videos here in Compton, most of the police officers refused to work the overtime assignments. But yet and still, they received a permit to do videos. I remember we did one on Long Beach and Alondra. And, you know, we had to provide security. So they would pick one training officer. He was a very senior guy, very well respected. And they would put us trainees or the younger officers that didn't have seniority. And we would be the ones assigned to work those. So you had a lot of police officers that just refused. They didn't want to work for those videos and those entertainments. And it had a lot to do with the F the police culture and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Death Row came along a few years later, and that's when they really got big. And we had a police officer that was very closely affiliated with Suge Knight. He actually retired and was no longer a police officer with Compton, but he did come back and he had recruited a lot of guys that that worked security there. But I want to say this. It's important to know that whereas Compton PD gained a lot of notoriety because the head security was former Compton, there were way more in numbers deputy sheriffs working Death Row security than Compton PD and LAPD as well. So, you know, you probably had, I'm going to say five guys at Compton PD working, but you had dozens of deputies and, you know, and dozens of LAPD officers. Because you got to remember, that was a big, big organization. You know, so Compton PD couldn't cover it by themselves. And, you know, you're only working these kind of assignments when you're in your off-duty time. Mm-hmm. So people will try to lean on that. Mm-hmm. But probably the largest number of people working and providing off-duty security were deputy sheriffs.
Oh, wow. You know, I don't really remember seeing too much of that in the historical record. So thanks for that. But so unfortunately, you know, even though Compton Police Department has this kind of cultural relevancy, you know, because of doing the off duty security for rap labels, unfortunately, the department was disbanded in 2000. The city council, Compton City Council, basically had a no confidence vote and voted to instead replace the Compton Police Department to contract with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Can you speak at all to why do you feel that the city council lost confidence in the Compton Police Department?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And like I said, let me give you a little bit of history on that. The sheriff's department, honestly, had been after Compton probably since the 70s. And remember, my dad worked for Compton PD since the late 60s. When they took over Linwood PD, they also wanted Compton PD. And the city had been putting it off and fighting it off for a very long time. Gosh, I want to make this simple because it's actually pretty in depth. Okay. But we had a chief of police that was not getting along with the mayor back then, and there was some butting of the heads. And really what happened was when that chief of police was removed from his position and the interim chief took over, there were a few people from Compton who had a little bit of authority. They had a lot of seniority that were very, very closely connected and very strong allies of the chief. And on the inside, they went after the city council, particularly the mayor. And they went after him by writing letters. You know, they were these anonymous letters called The Truth. And I was actually on the Compton POA board at the time. And I remember going in front of city council and speaking and saying, hey, we know you're getting these letters, but they do not speak for the entire department. And nobody would come forward. And we knew who was doing it. We found out who was doing it, but nobody would come forward and acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. So honestly, they really, really just kind of got under the skin. And they really got under the skin of the mayor. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was money. Mm-hmm. I think he was able to free up some money to go and contract with some other services. And part of it was, you know, you're coming after me. I know how to fix you. The sheriff's department has been wanting to get in here for years. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to, you know, that's how we're going to get back.
Okay, definitely. And so for people that might not be familiar with how certain cities don't have police departments and they're governed by or policed by the sheriff's department. Can you kind of like speak to that? I know Compton doesn't have its own police department. Linwood doesn't have one. I know Lancaster doesn't have one. And so, what is like the difference in a city having its own police department versus being allowing the sheriffs to have jurisdiction?
So the way it works is this. Most cities have what we call county areas. These are areas or pockets. We call them fingers sometimes. And it could be as short as a street, two blocks long, that for whatever reason, during zoning, did not get incorporated into that city. The county maintained that as part of their tax base, if the best way to put it. And so the sheriff is responsible for patrolling those areas. Well, oftentimes those areas are surrounded by, you know, city police departments. Mm-hmm. The sheriff's department is also responsible for providing law enforcement services to any city that does not have its own police department.
Okay.
So what's happened is you have some cities that never had their own police department, and the sheriff's department has always patrolled them. Mm-hmm. And then you have cities who have gone and changed their, maybe they've gotten rid of their police department and then moved into contracting services with LA County Sheriff. And that's all throughout LA County. Mm-hmm. Where I think this is unique is that if you look at, let's say, adjoining counties, let's say Riverside, San Bernardino, even Orange County, and I'm not really, you know, all that familiar with Orange County, but the sheriff's department is one that historically has been known for going out and recruiting and trying to get contract cities. If you go look at like Riverside County, they might have one or two. You know, if you go look at San Bernardino County, they may have, you know, one or two or a couple. But the sheriff's department is, you know, and I don't know the history behind that. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it's just a matter of providing, you know, law enforcement services for cities. And it's very costly. It's very expensive for a city to start up their own police agency, because now you got to put all that money on the front end, buying cars, equipment, training, a building, a location, whereas the sheriff's department can come in and say, hey, we can start tomorrow, you know, and just start giving the law enforcement services that you need. So it's a money issue.
Okay. And so who does the LA Sheriff's County, the LA County Sheriffs, who is there, you know, like who would be your boss if you were to be elected as the sheriff?
Well, the sheriff is a county department and it's under the Board of Supervisors. Okay. It's under the umbrella of the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. And so, which is another reason why Villanueva is an issue, is because he refuses to work in tandem with the Board of Supervisors, which is essentially his reporting, who he has to report to.
Well, a little bit of explanation. So for example, when you work in a city, mm-hmm. right, there's a city manager that does right. the hiring, and there's a city council that votes on things.
Right.
Right. So a city manager would hire a police chief. Mm-hmm. The residents vote in a sheriff. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic. Mm-hmm. Whereas the police chief's direct report or his boss is a city manager right. and a police chief can be hired and fired, a sheriff is elected. So the Board of Supervisors is the umbrella that covers fire department, probation, sheriff's department, Department of Mental Health, Public Works. You know what I mean? They're that umbrella mm-hmm. and they're the board. That oversees everything county, the sheriff is elected. And I think that's part of his issue, but he still has to go to the Board of Supervisors for approval for things, for budget. He still has to be able to work with them. And that's one of the things he's unable to do.
Mm. Okay, definitely. Your wife is also in law enforcement. Yes. Does she work for the sheriff's department as yes. well? Or? Okay. So how is that having also a spouse who is in law enforcement?
You know, it's good. I mean, everything has its pros and cons. You know, when you're in law enforcement at any given time, you know, you could be working on Christmas night at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, depending on your assignment, depending on your days off. So, you know, sometimes it's a scheduling issue. You know, okay. it's not like you have two people that go to work at 9, get off at 5, and you know what your day is set. Mm-hmm. Like I said, depending on your seniority, your assignment, you might be working days, nights, what we call graveyard early morning shift, which is all through the night. And, you know, we are a 365 operation. So you're going to miss birthdays and recitals and Christmas and Easter. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's that. We've always kind of been able to work it out. Mm-hmm. But it's also good because when you do have to say I'm working Christmas, nobody gets mad. You know what I mean? It's not like having a spouse that doesn't understand, like, why do you have to work on Christmas? Why can't somebody else do it?
Right.
You know, which a lot of, you know, people in law enforcement, they have some of those, you know, those battles. Why do you have to get called in? Why did you have to stay late? You know, why couldn't somebody else do it? Because, you know, you can miss, you know, the baseball games and the recitals and the dance lessons and those things. You know, it is possible to be out there. And there's also an understanding of what we deal with, you know, on a daily basis. And it's really great with her being on the department because there's an understanding of the internal politics that go on as well. You know, so we really are each other's sounding board. To be able to talk about things, bounce things off of each other. And when we share, we're talking to somebody that has, you know, that intimate internal knowledge about it. They're not just sitting there like, okay, I can't wait for him to stop talking about work. Or I can't wait for her to start talking about work. Mm-hmm. We can actually have some deep discussion about it. So it's a support system.
Okay, definitely. And I'm sure that's important in a tricky field of law enforcement.
Very.
So something that I saw when I was doing a bit of research is that your wife actually had filed a lawsuit for retaliation against like whistleblowing.
Mm-hmm.
So in what capacity does your wife work with the sheriff's department?
So she was a unit commander of the food services. I talked about that earlier mm-hmm. with, you know, all of the different locations. So that was her command.
Okay, definitely. You know, my ex, he spent a significant amount of time in prison for something he didn't do. You know, 70s and 80s in L.A., you know, it was easy to get caught up in that. And then the whole no snitching thing, right? But he told me that, because we were talking about something about milk and how he can't drink milk now. And he was like, it's crazy, though, because I used to drink milk every day when I was in jail, right? And then he was like, man, they're up in jail basically producing their own food. And he mentioned that they're like, I don't know, farming, or they're producing food in prison that they eat.
So you remember, prison and jail are two different things.
Right.
So the prison is the California correction system. And they, I don't know much about it,
okay.
but I have seen and heard that they may have, you know, land out there that they do farm, but not in our jails.
Right. So yeah, it's important to keep that in mind. Right. sheriffs and all that, that's county stuff. Prison is federal. Well, the federal prisons definitely got them inmates up in there farming or doing something, according to my ex. And just a lot of other stuff that I was very surprised to hear, you know. A lot of it is very depressing, you know, just in terms of like the prison. Oh, and I'm so sorry I'm going on this random tangent. But it's one thing to read about things in the books, you know, and read the Angela Davis, "Our Prison's Obsolete" and things like that. But it's like another thing when you're hearing the lived experience of someone that's been in prison, you know, decades, you know what I'm saying? And so I definitely hear you in terms of like not wanting to rebuild jails and prisons because the model is not, it's not good, you know? And then when our folks are released from prison, trying to get housing, trying to get a job, it's like, dang, you're living the whole thing again when you've just served your time, you know? But I digress. So in terms of your wife, your wife is in charge of food distribution for LA County jails.
Right. It's called Food Services Unit.
Food Services Unit. Yes. And so your wife felt that she was being retaliated against because she was calling out the food conditions.
So there's a lot to it. Okay. What you saw in the news was kind of the icing on the cake.
Okay.
Again, I said I had a history with Alex Villanueva, as did she.
Okay.
Many years ago, he actually got moved from a station and got in a little trouble for lying on us, attempting to get us in trouble. For what reason? I, to this day, have no idea, because he never even took the time to get to know us, to learn who we were. But again, it goes, it kind of goes to who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So again, now keep in mind, he becomes a sheriff.
Right.
He knows who we are. Mm-hmm. We're on a first name basis with him. There's no doubt in his mind that he knows exactly who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, once he came in and she was a unit commander at Food Services Unit, which, employed, you know, a couple hundred people, a lot of the cooks, the food managers. And like I said, you know, they do a lot of the industrial cooking. So when she went in there, she was making changes. She was doing things for the good. And she's given me carte blanche to talk about this.
Okay.
She has been somebody throughout her career that will stand up. And we're talking about her, that will stand up and say, that's not right. I'm not doing that. That's not right. And I'm going to let people know if you're doing something wrong. You know, so we both have, I mean, but you know, for her, it's one of those things where she is extremely organized, takes copious notes. So there had been things going on repeatedly over and over and over again since Alex took office.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things is, about $15 million comes missing from her budget, at one point, you know, and it's just gone. So, you know, and according to her, you know, part of the reason is, look, hey, we got to move some things around in the budget, but we know the Board of Supervisors is not going to let the inmates not eat. So you just keep processing your orders, right? And you just keep, you know, sending in your orders and ordering the food, the money will come. Well, you know, she spoke to that. It's like, well, wait a minute, hold up. You know, you're not going to tell, you're not going to come to me later and say, hey, that $50 million was mismanaged. It's missing by you. So she reported that. Mm-hmm. Employees that weren't doing their job, she reported that.
Mm-hmm.
Numerous things. So what ended up happening was she had been reporting a lot of things to her commander.
Mm-hmm.
And her commander wasn't handling them. She wasn't basically taking care of the things that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. She was putting it off repeatedly over and over again. And came the incident where there was moldy food being served to the inmates.
That's out.
And she reported that. Her commander was on vacation, right? So basically, commander was on vacation. The next thing we do is we go to the chief, reported it to the chief. The chief started asking her questions. Well, what about this? What about that? What about this? She says, well, are we really going to have this conversation right now? And the chief says, well, yeah. So she had said, look, I've been bouncing all of this stuff up the chain all along. So the chief in turn says, okay, well, you, the commander, and myself need to sit down and have a conversation because the commander was on vacation. Mm-hmm. Commander comes back from vacation. My wife gets called in by the commander. She's being told you're being put under investigation and you're being transferred. Now, there's another component to this, and that is the connection between this commander and one of the assistant sheriffs. And if you know anything about the sheriff's department, you got the sheriff, the undersheriff, and then you got the assistant sheriff. So there's a very, very close connection there. The relationship between the commander and the assistant sheriff apparently was bypassing the chief and keeping the chief out of it. So there's kind of like that direct line right to the sheriff. And honestly, you know, without delving too much into it, and please ask any clarifying questions you want, but, okay. You know, she was being retaliated against because once again, you know, she reported what was going wrong. She reported that there were people in her chain of command that mm-hmm. had been notified that weren't taking any action. And then of course, you know, they end up retaliating against her. And at some point she said, enough is enough. She's got 27 years on. You know, she's been doing this. She's at the tail end of her career. She's trying to do the right thing. And you have people just constantly trying to step on her. And rather than somebody coming and saying, hey, well, let's get to the bottom of this and fix it. No, they try to make her the problem. And it's going to be a problem for them. Because like you said, they have a law, you know, she has a lawsuit going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything will come out in the end. But I can tell you this, I know her. I know her integrity. I know her work ethic. Mm-hmm. I know her dedication to this department. She and I have, you know, I won't say fought, but, you know, we've talked about it many times. It's like, man, you're putting in a whole lot of hours,
right?
You know, and when you coming home? And she's like, hey, I just got to get it done. So I know her dedication. I know her integrity. I know her work ethic. And, you know, I know that she's always trying to do the right thing. And that's been a problem on this department for a long time, you know, and not just with her, but we see incidents regularly where employees come up and try to do the right thing and they report things and they end up becoming the ones ostracized.
So you're at the point where you're like, you know, we don't need any more kind of like think pieces or anything about this or press conferences. Like, gangs inside the police department, specifically the sheriff's department, you're acknowledging that that is real, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so I know that there's been a lot of conversation recently within the last year or so about these deputy gangs, which is nothing new at all to the police department, to police departments in general, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, we've had these platforms in LA that have basically, I feel it's important to talk about these issues, but they're nothing new. You know what I'm saying? They didn't uncover anything new. They just found a lane to exploit issues that affect Black and Brown people every day, right? And so, kind of like the first time I know that the community in LA in recent years probably started to hear about gangs and the sheriffs was a lawsuit against the police department after the shooting of a man in 2016 named Donta Taylor. And so through that lawsuit and investigation, you know, like the police had to come out and show their tattoos, and you know, this was kind of like really talked about, I feel like, in more dynamic ways from this guy's case in 2016, right? But again, gangs in the police department go back way, way further than that, right? But this is definitely an issue. And so I want to ask you, when did you become like familiar with the idea that there's like these sub cliques within law enforcement, a career that you chose to go into? Like, when did you start seeing issues with sub cliques?
You know, I didn't start seeing these issues until I got onto the sheriff's department. Okay. And I worked with Compton Police Department and Pasadena Police Department. And I think it's important to note that I'm going to digress just for a minute.
Yes.
And I'm going to talk about, you know, I went to the FBI National Academy in 2016. And they bring in, you know, top law enforcement leaders from all over the country for 10 weeks, 48 states, like 231 students. And I remember going around and kind of asking people, because it's a huge networking opportunity and we learn from each other, and asking other agencies, other states, hey, you know, are you guys experiencing these cliques, these gangs and this and that? And inevitably, every person said, oh, Eric, you know, we were going to ask you because we only hear about it from the sheriff's department. Mm. You know, you have people that will say it happens in every department. I don't believe that. I've heard Alex say that. I don't believe that. Anywhere you go in any profession, will there be a certain group of people that hang around together, congregate, go to concerts together, go to rivers, go to the river, you know, maybe go skiing, whatever it is. You know, you're going to have people with like interest,
right,
that are going to, you know, come together. I mean, right, we do it in high school. We do it in junior high, you name it. This is different. And this is different because, you know, we often hear that law enforcement is the biggest gang. But this is different because in our own stations, right, we have divisiveness. We have people that can be part of it and some that can't, right? Mm-hmm. So in our jails, if you work here, you can be part of it. But if you don't, you can't. So there's separation within our own ranks. And we've seen lawsuits, you know, where the employees have come in and spoken out. And again, what did I say? They're the ones that end up getting ostracized. Mm-hmm. So it first came to my attention with the sheriff's department. And I think it's very unique to our sheriff's department. It is something, like you said, it's been going on, I won't even say years, for decades.
Right. And so, again, you know, things kind of being, if you want to really eradicate this issue of deputy gangs, I know that you're going to have support, you know, beyond yourself. And again, what would be your response to someone that says, you know, I'm sure Eric Strong, he's going to go in there with the right mentality, but I just feel like it's too much for just him to fix, you know? What would you say to somebody that that would say that it's just too big of an issue for you to really eradicate gangs in the LA County Sheriff Department?
So I think I would ask him, so do we not even try? Do we just give up?
Right.
Do we quit? You know, or do you want to put somebody in there that's willing to take those steps forward? Listen, here's where it's important to know. You know, there's other candidates out there that have been on the department longer than I have been. And they've been in leadership positions longer than I have, very top leadership positions, and nothing's ever been done about it. And I can tell you, since 2000, in 21 years, the message on the inside from the very highest sheriff, undersheriff, assistant sheriff, chiefs has never been cut it out. Mm-hmm. It's not tolerated. We're not going to deal with it anymore. Even when Sheriff McDonald came in, you know, and he said he wanted to get rid of it, it was like, well, let's do a study. Let's do a panel. You know, you mentioned 2016. You know, I did an investigation it started in 2010. I finished it in 2011. One of the biggest investigations on our department that, you know, involved one of the deputy gangs. Mm-hmm. And they jumped on and did a gangster stomp of other deputies that worked at their same facility, but they didn't belong to their clique. So I don't need, you know, and when I had internal affairs, I would respond to these shootings and so forth. I was on the force and shooting team. You know, I don't need another panel, a commission, a report. You know, we don't need to put together some kind of blue ribbon panel to figure out what we know, what's been talked about for 30 years.
Right.
And where I think I'm different is that I've been acknowledging it all along. Right. You can never say that I was in a position to stop it and did nothing. But what you can say is that I'm willing to come forward, acknowledge it, and take affirmative, you know, relevant steps in order to stop it. It is going to take help from other people. But guess what? Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. If the leadership, and I'm going to digress for a minute. Here's where it's important to talk about why the sheriff's department differs from a lot of agencies. First of all, there is no legitimate, grievable testing process. to get into the executive ranks. So if you want to become a sergeant, you know, you become a deputy, obviously you got to test, go through a background. You want to become a sergeant, you got to go through this testing process, become a lieutenant. After that, there's nothing, right? So what does that mean? It means it's a tap on the shoulder. It means, hey, you know, Tina, I think I can, you know, you'll do what I want you to do. You know, come over here and be part of my executive team. And what that, and what the, what it really looks like is this. I need you to deliver my message, my way, right, when I tell you to, where I tell you to. And if you do that for me, I'm going to give you this path to better living. I'm going to promote you. You're going to make more money. You're going to have more responsibility. You're going to get a car, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not merit-based. And it's not based on what you've done. And the other thing is in order to continue getting that tap on the shoulder, because the other part of it is this, hey, if you do that for me good for a year or two, I'll promote you again. Mm. And then you do it and I'll promote you again. So as long as you keep showing me loyalty, you will keep getting the benefit. What that does is it silences people. It creates an environment where nobody's going to tell the emperor, you don't have any clothes on, right? Because, and what this sheriff has done, and other sheriffs in the past too, hey, if you go against me, off with your head, you got nothing coming. So other people don't want that to happen to them. So what really what you do is you silence. Nobody comes forward. So if the sheriff is saying there's no gangs, they don't exist, it's a softball club, it's a drinking club, guess what all of his executives are going to say? Nobody's going to come out and go to the news and say, hey, the sheriff is wrong.
Right.
Right? Because why? Because they want to keep their path to better living going.
Right.
We know it exists. People in the department know it exists. People are being silenced. And that silence, I can't even say it is something that started in 2018 with Alex Villanueva. That silence and that loyalty piece has been something that's been going on for decades, going back, you know, as long as I've been on, when, you know, when Baca was in office. So where it's different is, you know, number one is I am going to create a legitimate, testable, grievable process. You know, and people say, well, Eric, well, that'll kind of hurt you. You can't just pick who you want. I said, I get it, but I want the best people in there. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't necessarily want, I mean, there will be some executive ranks, you know, the highest of the highest, where you want your trusted confidence in there. But the message also will be from day one, and I'm saying it now, so nobody can come back and say, you never said this, but I'm saying it now, is that we got to get rid of them. We can't tolerate it. We got to hold them accountable. And I'm saying it now. We're going to put people in position that are not afraid to speak out about it. We're going to put the right leadership in the position because they're there. They do exist on the department, right? But they would get no support right now. And it takes the sheriff or a panel of the under sheriff and the two assistant sheriffs to terminate somebody. And if you know that's not going to happen, are you going to keep pushing and putting your neck on the line? Or are you going to sometimes at some point get to the point where you say, you know what, it's not going to happen. It's a lost cause. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the sheriffs have set the tone. You know, they set the tone. So what you're going to have in me is a sheriff that's going to come in and set the tone and says, nope, I've been talking about it for years. We're going to get rid of them and we're going to take steps. And there are different plans that I have out there to actually root them out. And I think once you get that person, you will get the support of many.
Okay, cool. So, Mr. Strong, let the people know where they can find you and where they can support your campaign.
So my platforms are strong4sheriff at gmail, at .com, and it's strong4sheriff. And I can be found on my website. You can find more about me. You can read up a few more things that tell you a little bit about, you know, who I am and what my policies and what my priorities are. And, you know, go there and support. Like I said earlier, in order to get into this position and to get the person in there to do the right thing, we need the votes. In order to get the votes, we need the exposure so that people know who I am and what I'm about. And in order to do that, you know, it really needs people to be educated,
right,
about going out and voting and knowing that they have a say in who is the sheriff over LA County. And I mean, and that goes all the way up to Lancaster, Palmdale, you know, as far south as, you know, the ocean, mm-hmm, west to the ocean and all the way out to the Riverside, county line, the Pomona, Claremont areas. And a lot of people don't realize that. They think, hey, you know what I mean? I got my own police agency. Can I vote? And mm-hmm. yes, you can. And to help me, donations, those $10, $20 donations add up in volume. And I would truly appreciate your support. And I make myself available for anybody that ever has questions or wants to talk about issues or incidents, because I'm willing to listen.
Okay, definitely. Well, thank you so much for your time. It is much appreciated.
Like this episode?
Leave a review and stay up to date on new episodes by subscribing to Sloss and Girl Speaks. And follow Sloss and Girl on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook.